Okay, well, buckle up, folks. This is where I get to say something I only say about once a year, sometime right after Simchat Torah, and that is turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins, where the whole book begins, literally, to the beginning place. That means first page, Genesis chapter 1, or Bereshit, and it goes like this. Now, let me do it in the Hebrew. I love the Hebrew, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but it says, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim vayet ha-aretz. So, Bereshit in the beginning, bara created. And that actually is a special word. It doesn't appear very often in the Hebrew because it means created, as the Latin would say, ex nihilo, out of nothing. There was nothing, then there was something. So it's a special kind of creation. It's not making, it's literally creating the very fabric of the universe, the matter, the energy, the space-time continuum, the whole nine yards. That kind of bara. Elohim. And et, of course, et is aleph tav, and it's the pointer to, well, what did he create? Ha shemayim va'et, and also et, he pointed to creating ha aretz, the heavens, that's plural, by the way, and the earth. Now, it says, the earth was tohu v'bohu. This is another one of those phrases I love. It's got a nice ring to it in Hebrew. It means without form and void. And interestingly, there's a whole bunch of speculation that has at least a little bit of spiritual foundation and scriptural foundation and maybe even physical foundation, in that we don't know, we're not told, how long there was between verse 1 and verse 2. Could have been seconds, could have been billions and billions of years, could have been a long time. We just don't know. But there is a suggestion, and I certainly can't debunk it because it's an argument from silence, that in between here, a lot of stuff happened, including the angelic war and all kinds of stuff. So again, it's interesting, but we really don't know, and so I mention it sometimes just in passing because there's so much that's fascinating in this in the beginning part. And by the way, I didn't mean to skip over, but I mentioned the Hebrew because one of the things that I have always thought was a real indicator of how divinely inspired and how created by the Almighty this was. If you look at that first sentence, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz, and you note that in the original Hebrew, in a Torah scroll, like we see it, there are no vowel pointers, there are no spaces. The words, the letters, they're all just run together. And it's Beit, Resh, Aleph, Sheen, Yod, Tav, and so forth. And it turns out, you could put the spaces somewhere else. And for example, if you did, it might say Bar, Ish, what? Bar, Ish, who? El. What did he create? Or there's several ways to look at it, but the creator of the fire or the creator of man. A similar word is man and ish with different vowel pointers, almost the same. Anyway, the creator of the of man is Yah, or the creator of the fire, the primordial photons is Yah. And there's other ways that you can parse this too. What's interesting to me is no less than seven, and they all have some meaning which is unique and true. And by the way, you can't translate it and have that effect in any other language. You have to pick one of the seven or one of the potentially lots and lots of them there to make it happen. So I think it's another just indicator of how much information is packed into this first amazing part of the book in the beginning. Okay, so it says, the earth was tohu v'bohu, darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the spirit, and that word is ruach, Yah, or Elohim, and when it says God in here, it's Elohim in almost all these places. The Ruach Elohim hovered over the face of the waters, Hamayim. And Elohim said, let there be light. And there was light. And this, too, is interesting to a physicist. Notice that before the creation of the sun, the moon, the stars, we have the creation of what? Light. Photons. The things that are the elemental elements there. So that at least rings true as well. Elohim saw the light. It was good. And Elohim divided the light from the darkness. And he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And now let's pause here again. so much information in just so few verses. He creates and then he divides. He causes a separation. And I think one of the real amazing elements of the creative process is this separation. Separating opposites, separating things that weren't separate before, but then they are. And light from darkness is one of them. And then it says, he called the light day, the darkness night, and there was evening and there was morning. This, of course, is where the Hebrew understanding of the day beginning at dusk in the evening comes from. There was evening first, then there was morning. Yom Echad. One day or the first day or a unified day. Then Elohim said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, let it divide. Here it is again, more division of the waters from the waters. And Elohim made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And Elohim called that firmament HaShemayim, or in this case just Shemayim, heavens. And again, notice it's plural, at least in the Hebrew. Then there was evening and there was morning, day, Yom Sheni. And Elohim said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together in one place, and the dry land appear. So he called the waters together, and the dry land appeared from under. It was so. And Elohim called the dry land, Eretz, earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And Elohim saw that it was tov, good. And he said, let the earth put forth grass, herb yielding seed, and fruit-bearing trees, fruit, after its own kind. Wherein is the seed thereof upon the earth? So one of the elements of the creation here, and this is always fascinating as well, of fruit and fruit-bearing trees, is that these things propagate. They have the ability to recreate themselves according to their own kind. And the seed is contained within the fruit. Then the earth brought forth grass, herb-yielding seed after its kind, and tree-bearing fruit. Wherein is the seed thereof? And that's got to be important because it's now been mentioned twice. This element that the characteristic of life and of plant life is that it bears seed, whether it's grass seed or fruit, and it then propagates according to its own kind. And by the way, that's why I suggest that Monsanto's Terminator gene-infused genetically modified Frankencorn is not real food. It's not even life. It doesn't even have this basic capability to bear fruit of its own kind according to its seed, because the seed is dead, and it kills too. The earth brought forth grass, herb yielding seed after its kind, bearing fruit, and this contained the seed thereof after its kind. And again, Elohim saw that it was tov, ki tov, was good. There was evening and there was morning. So here it is again, a third day, yom. Shlishi. And Elohim said, let there be lights. Now we're talking about the creation of the stars and those kind of things that are providing light in the sky. Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of HaShemayim, the heavens, to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And Elohim made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And Elohim set them in the firmament of the heavens, HaShemayim, to give light upon all Haaretz, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide, again, the light from the darkness. And Elohim saw that it was Tov. There was evening, there was morning, day four. And Elohim said, let the waters now swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let the fowl fly above the earth in the open firmament of HaShemayim, the heavens. And Elohim also created the great sea monsters and every living creature that creeps on its legs, whether there's a few or many, wherewith the waters swarmed after its kind, and every winged fowl after its kind. And Elohim saw too all of this, that it was tov, good. And I wanted to double check that. Oftentimes, that word the sea, the great sea creatures, is talanim. Okay, I'm not sure exactly how that translates it. Okay, but sometimes it's behemoth as well. That is a word. That's not the case here. And Elohim blessed them, saying, Here is arguably, it's one of the first commandments that's given to man. Well, actually, it is the first commandment, but it's also the commandment that's given to the things that he's just created. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the waters of the seas and let fowl multiply in the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, day five, Yom HaChamishi, the fifth day. And Elohim said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after its kind, cattle and creeping things, and beast of the earth after its kind. And it was so. Now notice again, we saw at first the pattern with the plants and the trees. Now we're seeing it again with the living creatures, all of them. They bring forth seed after their own kind, and the seed is essentially, like in the case of mankind, the seed would be in the male and the female coming together and the creation of a new generation. But this pattern is part of, I think, one of the major defining characteristics of life. It's kind of fascinating. I remember thinking and talking about this for years. You know, for all of the great technological strides that man is said to have made, still yet, nothing that can create according to its own kind. You can copy a program. That's about as close as they've gotten. But as far as creating some kind of a physical machine that can reproduce another physical machine, no, man hasn't ever even remotely come close. Elohim then made the... By the way, I did that discussion one time on a forum, and I had a guy send me this scientific paper saying, that's not true, you can't say that. And I read the paper, and the paper basically said, we took some various kinds of single-celled creatures, and we modified them, and look, they can reproduce after their own kind. We have done it. I thought, that's a bunch of hooey. That is just taking his dirt and making something out of his dirt. You know, you've heard the old joke. Don't give me that as a creative thing akin to what Yah did. There's a long ways to go from that. Okay, anyway, so Elohim made the beasts of the earth after his kind, the cattle after their kind, everything that creeps upon the ground after its kind, and Elohim saw that it was tov. And here we go. Now, at this point, Elohim says, let us... Now, this is... Remember, Elohim is what's sometimes called the royal plural. It is, in the case of lesser fakes, imitations, fake gods, mighty ones, it's plural. And in the case of Elohim himself, it is also sometimes called the royal plural. Okay, it's the form of the noun here is plural. But he, of course, is echad, a unity and a singular. It's kind of like a flock of sheep is echad, and it is called a flock, one flock. That's not a good analogy because he is a whole lot bigger than anything like that. But it also explains why this translation is correct, and it was confusing to me when I was a kid. Let us, let us make man in our image. Well, the verb tense and conjugations and so forth in the Hebrew are consistent with Elohim. In other words, it's the plural. But let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over all the fowl of the air, over all the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So he creates man in his own image and likeness, and he, that creation, now has dominion over everything that we've seen created up until this point. And Elohim created man in his own image. In the image of Elohim created he him. And here's another one that's interesting. This, of course, runs afoul of what is now taught in the indoctrination centers and places where little kids are dumbed down and turned into something different than what they were supposed to be. Because it says male and female, he created them. Male and female. That's pretty basic. You'd think it would be elemental. You'd think it would be taught in the United States military. You'd think it would be taught in schools. But not anymore, because insanity is taught instead. But it's real fundamental. And one other thing, folks. As I go through here, will point out, a lot of this is thus politically incorrect. It's scientifically correct. It's biologically correct. It's scripturally correct. It's true in every way. But the fact that politically correct it ain't tells you that political correctness is... I can say this. It's the stuff that Elohim made that comes out of the creeping creatures and the cattle and lays in the field. Male and female created them, and he blessed them. And Elohim said unto them, here comes the first command to mankind. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over all those things we just heard, over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over every living thing that creeps upon the earth. And Elohim said, behold, I have given you, meaning mankind, every herb yielding seed, which is upon the face of all ha'aretz, and every tree in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for food. And to every beast of the earth, and every fowl of the air, and to everything that creeps upon the earth, wherein there is a living soul, the word there is nephesh, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. And Elohim saw that everything he had made, and behold, it was... Now here's the singular exception, the end of chapter 1, after the creation of mankind, and now it says it is not just tov, it's tov meod. Really good. It is very good. There was evening, there was morning, the sixth day. So chapter 2 tells us, and now we have this place where Hashemayim and Haaretz, Kol, all of them, were finished, and all of the host of them. And on the seventh day Elohim finished his work which he'd made, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he'd made. And Elohim blessed the seventh day, and he hallowed it. He set it apart. Because in it he rested from all his work which Elohim, in creating, had made. And then we get the summary. These are the generations, the toldot, of Hashemayim and of Haaretz, when they were created, in the day that Yahuwah, and, wait a second, now that's interesting too, in the day that Yahuwah, Elohim, created Hashemayim and Haaretz. Actually, it says backwards this time, that Elohim made earth and heaven. So it's Eretz ve-Shemayim. I'll make a couple of observations here. One, in Genesis, obviously, there's going to be a whole bunch of times where we're going to see a word that appears, and it'll be the first time that the word is used, obviously. So a lot of the basic understandings for a lot of the words, what's called the doctrine of first use, it's a way of understanding what a word means when we see it in context and know how it's used. And also, this is the first use of his name, the tetragrammaton, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yahuwah. And it's Yahuwah Elohim here. And notice that it's going to be a long time until we see that name in common usage, essentially in Exodus. But it does appear here in Bereshit. No shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no herb of the field had yet sprung up, for Yahuwah had not caused it to rain upon Haaretz, because there was not a man to till the ground. But there went up a mist from the earth, Haaretz, and watered the whole face of the ground. Now, one other interesting thing here. There is a word that appears here, not just earth, the peni, there's the word face, and ha-adama. Ha-adama is the ground. You notice there's a word contained within that? Adama ends in the feminine form, and Adam is literally the name that's going to be given to the first man, but he's representative of the entire species, so literally mankind is Adamkind, or is just Adam. And what we're going to see right coming up here, and this is where it is prefaced, out of Ha-Adama, the ground, is created Ha-Adam, the man. We're getting there. So, Yahuwah then formed Ha-Adam. He formed Et Ha-Adam. So that's the pointer, the Aleph Tav, pointing to the creation, the man, from Ha-Adama. And he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, chaim, and the man became a living nefesh, a soul. He has a ruach, and he has a soul. And there's an interesting terminology in here, which is a ruach mamaya, or mamala, and it means a speaking ruach, a speaking spirit. And one of the characteristics, in other words, of mankind is this ability, and think about it. This is how Yah just finished creating the earth, to speak things into existence. Speech is not only communication, but speech is a powerful understanding, and it literally comes right out of the fabric of Genesis here. How vital it is to understand speech and this power of speech. Okay, and Yahuwah planted a garden eastward in Eden. And there he put the man, Ha-Adam, whom he had formed. Out of Ha-Adama, the ground, made Yahuwah, Elohim, to grow. Now notice here it again is, now that we've seen Yahuwah, that name is appearing several times in here. And Yahuwah Elohim did these things. Out of the ground, the Adama, made Yahuwah, Elohim to grow all of the trees, every tree that is pleasant to the sight, good for food. The tree of life, too, was in the midst of the garden, and this tree that's called the tree of the knowledge of Tov Verah. Tov, right? Good. Verah, and Ra, or evil. A river, it says, went out of Eden to water the garden. From there, it was parted. It became four heads. The name of the first one is Pishon. That is it which compasses the whole land of Havilah, where there's gold. And of the gold of that land, it's good. There's bdellium and the onyx stone. Excuse me, the onyx stone. And the name of the second river is Gihon. The name that is in that one, it compasses the whole land of Cush. Now, nowadays we think of Cush, generally it's rendered as Ethiopia. And some of you know who... now I'm drawing a blank. Stan Deo. That has done a lot of research, and he believes that the Garden of Eden was literally located in Tanzania, and has been to the place where it comes out of the mountains, and it meets all these criteria. It's kind of interesting. So he makes a pretty good case. Ethiopia obviously is down in that vicinity, so all of that is consistent. The place that he has said it is consistent with some of the description that's given here. Doesn't prove it, but it certainly makes for kind of a compelling case. The name of the third river is the Tigris. That is it which goes toward the east of Ashur. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. And it says here, and took they, and this word is, the root word is lachach. Lachach. He took the man. And we'll notice that that's the first use of that word. It's also the same root word that's used when a man takes a wife. Or a lot of things are taken. But now Yahuwah takes the man, puts him in Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, in order to dress it and to keep it. And Yahuwah Eloheka commanded the man, saying the following. So here is the first use of the word zavah, the command. And it's in the peel form, which is the conjugation that says it's emphatic. In other words, really, really important. Do this and understand it. He commanded him in no uncertain terms, in other words, saying, of every tree in this whole garden, you may freely eat. But, just this one command, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, Tov Verah, you are not to eat of that. For in the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. And Yahuwah Elohim said, it's not good that the man should be alone. I will make, and this is one of those words that always kind of leaps off the page at me, not a wife, that's not the term that's used yet, it'll be used shortly here, but it's a helper who is meet, a helper who is appropriate for him. And the Hebrew word there is etzer kenegdo. And there's an implication in this word too. It's a helpmeet that is opposite to him. So the creation has not happened yet, but when it does, remember how this creation works. He divides. He's going to divide Adam, and he's going to take from Adam, and Adam's going to later do some naming here. So I'm getting a little bit ahead of the story, but I want as we go through it to make it as clear as we can. This helper that is meet for him also has kind of an implication in the language that she is opposite to him. In lots of respects, she is an opposite to him. She's a complement, is another way to put it, to him. Out of the ground, the Adamah, Yahuwah Elohim formed every beast of the field, every fowl of the air. He brought them all unto the man to see what he would call them. And this too, why is this in here? It's kind of fascinating. As you go through Genesis, you'll see there are lots of things. You go, well, you know, this is interesting, but how about this? He doesn't tell us that. He doesn't tell us a whole lot of things about how this happened and how various things came to pass. But what he does tell us is kind of fascinating because of what is included. And this is one of those. And I've heard a really wonderful explanation. I like it, and I'll probably talk more about it tomorrow. I tend to do, because there's so much meat in this particular well, not just the whole book, but certainly in this first Torah portion, it's almost impossible to talk about all the elements. So when I go through it on Friday night, I'll try to at least touch on them, but I can't do them justice. But in any case, this idea here is of what's called naming authority. Notice exactly how it's phrased. He brings, Yah brings all of these beasts and fowl to the man, Ha Adam, to see what the man would call them. He has been given the power of speech. And his power of speech here is literally important enough that what it says is, whatever the man says that this thing is, he has now given it its name. That's a pretty powerful authority, right? It's been called naming authority. He calls them, that's what they are. Whatever he called every living creature, that was the Shem, the name thereof. The man then he named, he gave names to all of the cattle, all the fowl of the air, every beast of the field. But notice this. But for Adam there was not found an etzer kenegdo for him. So I think part of the layout, and by the way, this is fundamental because if you think about it, what we're seeing here is the prototype for human procreation, the prototype for marriage, the prototype for all of the biblical authorities that flow from all the things that we're seeing right here in Bereshit. And it is extremely fundamental. He is basically not only giving Adam naming authority, and we're going to see this continue, but he also is bringing these animals to him and making a case. Right? Hey, you like the lion? You think maybe the lion should be your companion from here on out? Well, lions are fine, but no, it's not quite right. That's not the helper that is suitable for you. How about lions and tigers and bears? Oh my, nope, not those. How about creeping things? You know, slugs? No. How about eagles or peregrine falcons? Nope, none of those. Fish? No, not gonna. He has not found among all of the myriad of creatures any etzer kenegdo for Ha'adam. So, Yahuwah Elohim caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept, and he took. Now, this is another one of those words. I have never been real wild about the idea of a rib, right? Adam's rib. The Hebrew word here is metzlatin, which seems to probably better be rendered as sides. He took one of Adam's sides. Now, that word in the English, I think, also fits better because, well, what side? Like he has a good side and a bad side? No, I'm not saying that. Like he has this aspect and that aspect? One side is this way and the other side is that way? Is it physically half of his body? We're not really told. But notice one thing, male and female, he created them, we've already been told. We know that there are some biological differences. The ones go in where the others go out. And there are things that are complementary to the point that they fit and they are used in the creative work, right? I'm trying to be as genteel as I can about this. But basically, he took one of Adam's sides and he closed up the place that was there with flesh. And this side, which Yahuwah Elohim had taken from the man, mean Ha'adam, literally taken mean or from Ha'adam, he made at a Isha. La-Isha. Now, that word is rendered here as woman, but remember, in Hebrew, Isha also means wife. And the only way to really tell the difference is by context, because the exact same word. Well, in this case, I think really it is, in fact, a wife that he has just created for Adam. So maybe that would be a better rendering, but usually the Muslim says he made a woman. And he brought her unto all Ha'adam. So think about this, right? Adam has naming authority. He was the first created. There's a temporal authority, as people will point out. And now we're going to see that the woman is brought from Adam to Adam. And the man says, and everybody's heard this one, right? This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken from man. So Isha, because she was taken from Ish, out of man. Now then we get this little bit of a philosophical observation, or a truth. Therefore it says, shall a man leave his father and his mother, from which he came, although at this point we haven't seen any of that actually happening, but we know it's gonna, and he shall cleave unto his Isha, his woman, and they shall be flesh echad. Echad, literally, not just one flesh, but a unity of flesh. And arguably, if you think about the bigger picture here, out of procreation comes what? Flesh echad. The seed and the egg join. There is new life. There is new flesh. It literally is flesh that is echad of both of the two parts that were separated and then are rejoined. And then it says finally this, they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. Now, that word is kind of an interesting root word, too. Can mean other things. They're not disconcerted. They're not disappointed. They're not confounded. So, whatever it is, it's not a problem for them. Yet. Now let's pause there, and I'm going to make an observation here that I often make right up front, Bereshit in the beginning, and if I said it, I don't remember having said it, but I should have. This is, in fact, one of my very favorite Torah portions, and also it's too big. When the rabbis, the sages, when they divided up the Torah, I wish they would have basically probably stopped at the end of chapter 2 and said, "Boy, that's a lot of stuff. Why don't we pause there and we'll talk about the rest, because there's a whole lot more that's very, very important. Matter of fact, probably one of the most important stories in the whole book is going to happen right here in Genesis chapter 3. So it's my favorite, and it's also too big because there's just so much to talk about here. And let's go into Genesis chapter 3, and we'll spend as much time. Now, we won't spend as much time as it takes because we'll be here all night. However, let me go through this at least fairly slowly. It says, now, we got this new creature. This is the first time this word appears. The word in the Hebrew is nachash. Ha-nachash. And I do like a serpent better than a snake. Why? Well, because I don't think that this creature, this nachash, is exactly what a snake is. We're going to see in a little bit that it's changed, and it doesn't look like it used to. Serpent is a better rendering. As a matter of fact, there's even a case to be made. I won't go into it here because we don't have time because there's so much meat, right? But there's a case to be made that even dragon might be a better rendering than serpent. You know, or the picture you always see with the snake holding a little thing in its hissy mouth, giving it to Hava, who's not been named yet, by the way. But it does say this. This thing, this nachash, ha-nachash, was, in fact, more arom. Arom. What's that word mean? It's the only time the word arom appears in the Torah. Isn't that interesting? So, what does it mean? Well, it says more subtle in this English rendering I'm looking at. Subtle is too subtle. It leaves me cold. How about this? The nachash was more crafty. He was more shrewd. Shrewd is probably a good word. Not necessarily evil. We might want to put that in there. But crafty is a good word. Shrewd. Conniving. There's another word. Then any beast of the field which Yahuwah Eloheka had made. Yahuwah Elohim. And he, this nachash, who obviously has some ability to speak, says unto Ha-Isha, has Elohim said, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? Now, what he's done here is he's laid a trap. The woman says to Ha-Nachash, of all of the fruit of the trees of the garden we can eat. Okay, so far so good. But of the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, Elohim has said, you shall not eat of it. Now, if she'd stopped there, we'd probably still be having a great time in the garden. But she didn't. For reasons that Torah does not tell us, and it's fascinating, and certainly there's a lot of speculation. You know, you can obviously guess. Did she make this up? Did Adam make it up, trying to protect her and add some stuff to it? Don't know. But the point is, somebody added to the single, simple, emphatic, peel command, and good old crafty, shrewd, conniving Nakash drove a truck through it. He literally used that little addition to mess things up pretty royally. So she says, you shall not eat of it. So far, so good. Nor shall you touch it. Nope. That is not the commandment. And later we're going to see in Deuteronomy, at least twice, do not add to, do not subtract from. Well, this is a really good example of why that makes sense. Lest you die. Now that part is true, although it's not necessarily immediately. He says on the day. What does that mean? Is a day like a thousand years? Yeah, you know. But on the day that you eat of it, you become mortal, and your fate is sealed, is another way to think of it. All right. Then Akash says unto the woman, hey, no, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. You're not going to surely die. Lo, mot. Not sure. Lo, not die. Mot. You won't really surely die, because Elohim knows something. In the day that you eat of this thing, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as God. You'll be like God, knowing tov ve-ra, good and evil. Now, I will contend to you that there are in this verse the two greatest and first lies in all of history. Okay? Number one, you shall not surely die. Number two, you will be like God. You can be like God. And I can't help but think, look and see, folks, what we're seeing today with artificial intelligence and the soul of the machine and transhumanism and all this stuff. It's literally a repetition of the same two first lies in all of human history. You will not die. No, no, we can transmute your soul into the machine. We can modify you. We can make you better. You can be like God. You can be so much better. You can be like God. By the way, not only knowing good and evil, but calling evil good and good evil. Haven't we seen all of this? It's fascinating, in other words, how so much of not just the things that we see, but the elements of the reasons for the things that we see are all right here in Bereshit, in this first Torah portion. So, the Isha, Ha-Isha, she saw that the tree was good for food, and it was delightful to look at, it was a delight to the eyes, and the tree was desirable to make one hacham, wise. So, she took some of it, and she ate it. Now, let's pause there. And I always try to emphasize this, because it's one of those things that once you see it, you can't unsee it. She ate it. What happened? No, nothing. It does not say anything. If the scripture is very, very carefully worded, and the sequence is important, and if something had happened at that instant, we would have been told. But that's not what it says. So she took of it and she ate. And is it later? Yeah, it's definitely later. How much later? Was it seconds? Was it minutes? Was it hours? We don't know. And it says, she gave also unto her husband with her. Now, was he with her when she first ate it? Was he silent? Did he come back later? Again, we don't know. We cannot tell from here. But I'm going to suggest that the key is the next verse and the thing that follows. Now remember, we've already been talking about Adam. Adam has various kinds of authority, one of which we're not told yet. We're going to see it. It's something I think is vital. It shows up in Numbers chapter 30. Adam, we find out later. Now, by the way, this is not unique to this situation. Noah, long before it was written down as what are the clean animals and the unclean animals, Noah gets a commandment. We're going to see it in the next week's Torah portion. He knows what's clean and what's unclean. How does he know? Same way that Adam seems to know about certain authorities. By the way, he walks with Yah, we're going to find out. So all of these things are clear, and they're indicative, at least, of what we can look and glean from the story. Well, here we go. So she took the fruit and she ate. It looks like nothing happened instantly. Now, at the point where she ate, was her fate sealed? That, I think, is a real key question. I'm going to contend. Now, you don't have to agree with me, but I think if you connect the dots, I can make a pretty good case. Her fate was not yet sealed. Why do I say that? She gave to her husband with her, and then he ate. Okay, he ate. He did eat. And then, and I'll add the word only then, because it looks like the language implies it is after both had eaten. It is after Adam has ratified the choice, and only after the ratification of that choice. Then the eyes, notice the word here is both of them were opened. Then the eyes of both of them were opened. So the language is clear. It happened after Adam also ate that now the eyes of both of them were opened. So something happened, not when the first one ate, but only when Adam ratified the choice. Then they knew that they were naked, and they went and they sewed themselves some fig leaves together, and they made themselves girdles. And now they heard the voice, call of Yahuwah Eloheka, Yahuwah Elohim, walking in the garden towards the cool of the day. And the man and his Isha, it's Adam again, and his wife hid themselves from the presence of Yahuwah Elohim among the trees of the garden. Now, they think they can really hide? It doesn't seem to matter because he knows. And we're going to get some rhetorical questions here. Yahuwah then called unto the man and he said to him, where are you? Now, here's another one of those places. You know, Rashi has some commentary. I think it's fairly straightforward. It's not like Yah doesn't know. But he is offering an opportunity for the man to fess up and suggest and maybe understand something out of this exchange. Where are you? And the man says, well, I heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. You're what? Right? He said, who told you you were naked? Have you eaten of that tree which I had commanded you that you should not eat? Now, here we get a little glimpse at human nature as well. This is one of those things where there's an element of it's sad, but at the same time, it's because sad is sometimes humorous. The man says, "Oh, it's your fault. That's that woman, the one you gave me, right? Oh, she gave me that tree, and I ate." Yahuwah then says unto the woman, "What is this you've done?" Woman said, "Well, it's serpent's fault. The Nechash, that thing, he beguiled me. He tricked me. He enticed me, enchanted me. He didn't really deceive me, but he beguiled me. And I ate." Okay, so here we are. Now, this is another one of those places we've got to slow down and read carefully. Because notice what happens. One of the things that people, a lot of times out of Sun God Day school, they'll say, "Oh, here, man is cursed." No, man is exiled from the garden. But notice what is cursed and what is not cursed. Man is not cursed. So let's read it carefully. So Yahuwah says first to Ha-Nechash, "Because you've done this, cursed are you from among all the cattle, from among all the beasts of the field, and upon your belly you shall go. Dust you shall eat all the days of your life." So this is the place where I will suggest, up until this point, Nechash didn't go around on his belly. After this point, he does. Something physically changed in Nechash at this point. And that, on that, at least, we're not sure exactly, did his legs disappear so he has to slither? That's probably the implication. Can't make that claim with 100% certainty, but it sure looks like it. Other people will point out, there are actually such things as snakes, serpents, that are of that genus that have the slithering characteristic, that actually have what's called vestigial legs, little teeny useless legs that you can see. So that's always been interesting to me. Anyway, he says the following, "I'll put enmity between you and Ha-Isha," the wife, the woman, "and between her seed and your seed and her seed, actually. And they, her seed, they will bruise your head, and you will bruise their heel." Now, let me make one more observation. We're not going to see it yet, but we actually have seen it in here. And that is, Elohim is said, and I believe this is absolutely the case, he knew the end from the beginning. So at this point, he already knew what was going to happen. I think he had the plan laid out all the way through the redemption. And that one of those glimpses is right here between her seed and your seed. They'll bruise your head, you shall bruise their heel. Then he turns to the woman. So he's working his way up temporally in the same order as the sequence went down. Unto the woman, he now says, "I will greatly multiply your pain and your travail. In pain shall you bring forth children, and your teshuka," this is an interesting word, "your teshuka shall be unto your husband, and he shall rule, shall reign, shall have dominion over you." It's fascinating, and I've already emphasized this. The man has naming authority. The man had temporal authority. And the man failed to properly exercise that. I will suggest, cannot prove this, because we'll never know what would have happened. Would there have been persistence? Would they have screwed it up another day? Very likely possible. But in any case, I have a strong suspicion, because of what we see in Numbers 30, that had Adam not ratified the decision that Chava, we're going to see her named later now, if he had not ratified that decision and gone ahead and eaten of the fruit, he could have cast down that decision and that fruit would have had no effect on her. That certainly seems to be the implication. Now, think about it, and I always like to, at this point, now that we're seeing the curses and the penalties being doled out, ask yourself what was going through Adam's mind. He knows he's been caught, and his Isha has just done something that he knows shouldn't ought to have been done. I think he cares a lot for her. I think he's thinking, wow, this is, he took half from me. She's bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. I'm going to watch her die. On the day that she eats, she dies. You know what? Maybe I don't want to live without her. Maybe if I follow her down this road, maybe Elohim will let us off the hook somehow. I don't know exactly. Don't claim to know what was going through the man's mind. But I do know this. He was a sharp fellow. And he may very well have understood that he could have cast down the vow. But I can't help but think that one of the elements of fear, and again, all of this is speculation, I just encourage folks, as you read through the story, kind of put yourself in the position of the characters, and maybe certain things then begin to be more clear. or less clear even. You know, it's easy to step back and say, well, it was a really stupid thing he did. He shouldn't have done that. But among other things, the possibility is he's thinking, wow, she's sealed her fate. She's going to die. He's told me. On the day that she eats from that tree, she did it, she's going to die. And even if I cast down the vow, what happens? Can I save her? Do I have that power? I don't know. But I don't want her to die. I think I'll just go with her. So it's a fascinating glimpse, at least, at human nature. And, well, look, it resonates literally throughout the millennia. That's what's fascinating about it. So what does he say to her? In pain you'll bring forth children, and your teshuka will be unto your husband, and he shall rule over you. It's rendered as desire, and it's kind of fascinating. The sages will point out that teshuka is only, there's only four kinds of teshuka in the world. I won't go through the detail. It's an interesting study. But essentially, there is the creator has teshuka. He has a desire for his creation. Okay, it's kind of a caring and understanding. The one that's fascinating is rain has teshuka for the land. Rain has teshuka for the land. Now notice the way that that's phrased. This is the one that is the most revealing. Desire. Rain has desire for the land. Well, you know, that's backwards, isn't it? You'd think that the land, which is in need of rain to bring forth fruit and plants and all that kind of jazz, it would be the land that would desire the rain. But no. The teshuka thing is kind of fascinating because it implies a fitness of purpose. In other words, what is the purpose of the woman, Ha'isha? It's to be the etzer kenegdo for her husband. She was created as his opposite, this helpmeet. And she has, now it's been emphasized, your desire shall be for your husband and he will reign over you. She has this teshuka. And the desire is like the desire, the same word that's used, of the rain for the land. How does that fit? Well, because the purpose of the rain is to nourish the land, to provide sustenance, literally to give life to the land. Think about it in that sense. Now it begins to make a lot of sense. The etzer kenegdo, her teshuka, her desire, is like rain for the land. It is to nourish. It is to be the provider of sustenance and stability. In other words, all the good things that make her the etzer kenegdo are right here in this one verse. Now he turns to Adam, the man, and he says, because you have what? Hearkened, heard and obeyed. Well, this is that word, shema. Because you have shemad unto the voice of your Isha. Shouldn't it be the other way around? You ate of that tree which I told you you weren't supposed to eat from, saying, you shall not eat of it. Well, here is the penalty. Notice, who is cursed? And remember, the word et points to the direct object. Cursed is ha-adama. Isn't that funny? Out of adama comes Adam. And it's not ha-adam that is cursed. It is ha-adama, the ground that is cursed. Get this, for your sake. For your sake. The thing that you were taken from is cursed for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles too, it's going to bring forth to you. You'll eat the herb of the field, and it's going to be in the sweat of your face, the sweat of your brow, you'll eat bread, till you return to that from which you were taken, right? From back into Ha'adama. For out of it you were taken, dust you are, and unto dust you shall return. The fate is sealed. You were immortal. As of this day, that's no longer true. And the man at this point, now, he calls his wife's Shem, her name, Chava, because she is the mother of all living, Kol Chai. And Yahuwah himself, he made for Adam and for his Isha, again, she's still called the Isha at this point, garments of skins, and he clothed them, or coats out of skins. And Yahuwah said, behold, the man has become as one of us, here's that royal plural again, to know good and evil, tov vera. And now, lest he put forth his hand and eat from that other tree, remember there's two of them in there, and eat from that, and then live forever, Yahuwah is going to exile him. The word here is shalach. And this is another one of those Hebrew words that's fundamental to a lot of understanding. It's a very simple word. A tree shalachs out a branch, and a leaf, and a bud. It's to send forth. But also, it can mean exile, and also, when a man puts away a wife, it's the same word that's used there, to send out his Isha. Elohim then shalaks both of them, Hadam and literally mankind, from the garden, Gan Eden, to till the ground from whence he was taken. So, he drove out, he garash, he expelled the man, and it's also in the Peel conjugation, very emphatic. He pitched them out of there. He threw them out, expelled them. Ha-Adam. And notice it says Ha-Adam. Et Ha-Adam. And he placed at the east side of the garden of Eden, Gan Eden, he placed the cherubim and the flaming sword which turns every way to keep the path, the way to the tree of life. And now it says, notice that we aren't told that it didn't happen before, but what we are told here is that the man, Ha-Adam, knew. And the root word here is fascinating too. The word is yada, right? Yada, yada, yada. You remember that from the comedy show, Seinfeld. Yada, yada, yada. Well, yada is the Hebrew word that means to know, but it's an intimate form of knowing. He knew her intimately, right? He conceived with her, so there's a conjugal understanding. That's the kind of knowing that he now has. And she conceived, and she bore Cain, and said, I have gotten a man with the help of Yahuwah. And again, she bore his brother. His name is Abel, or Abel. Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought the food of the ground as an offering unto Yahuwah. Now, this is kind of fascinating, too, and we're not explicitly told why. As you might suspect, no shortage of speculation on this one. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And Yahuwah had respect unto Abel and his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering, the fruit of the ground, he had no respect. And Cain was pretty upset. He was wroth, and his countenance fell. And Yahuwah asked him, here's another one of these rhetorical questions, why are you so upset? Why are you wroth? Why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, shall it not be lifted up? And if you do not do well? Now, listen to this and see if there is, even in the English, you can kind of see it. In the Hebrew, I think it leaps off the page at us. And here's another one of those places where there's just so much in this. It says here, if you don't do well, sin crouches at the door. Sin crouches at the door. Huh, that's kind of an interesting metaphor. And unto you is its, ready? Here's a word we just saw. It's only used rarely. Unto you is its teshuka. Its desire, teshuka. But you may rule over it. You may have dominion over it. Wait a second. Let's just turn back. Didn't we just read the very same thing? Yeah, we did. It's in verse 16 of chapter 3. Unto the woman, he uses the same word in the same form. In one case, he's talking about the wife saying, your teshuka will be for your husband, and he will have dominion, he will rule, reign over you. And now, he's talking to Cain, and he says, look, sin crouches at the door, and its teshuka, the teshuka of sin, is for you, but you may rule over it. Wow. The form, it's exactly a chapter earlier, and the form of the, in one case, advice, and in the other case, the I won't say the curse, but it is a curse. But it is the penalty, if you will, for what she has done. It's the very same. I don't think there's any coincidence whatsoever there. So when you see this kind of stuff, here's the pattern. Pay close attention. By the way, what's going to happen? Well, we already know. We've read the story. Cain spoke unto Abel, his brother. Came to pass, there in the field, Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and he slew him. He murdered him. He slayed him. He killed him. We're going to get another one of those rhetorical questions. Then Yahuwah says to Cain, hey, where's Abel, your brother? He knows. And he says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? And he, it's capitalized in English as if we're not sure who it's talking about, but we know. Why have you done this? What have you done? The voice of your brother's dam, his blood, cries out to me from, what else? Ha-Adama. And now notice, first, the ground is cursed for Adam's sake. Cain, on the other hand, has committed murder. First one we see in Scripture. And he is, in fact, cursed directly. And that's what it says here. What have you done? You now are cursed from what else? Ha Adama. Now, what was it that Cain did? He was a tiller of the soil. He raised fruits. He was a farmer. He now is cursed from the thing which was his livelihood, from Ha'adama. And why? Because it has opened up, Ha'adama opened up her mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. Now, it's kind of fascinating. This word opened up her mouth, the ground opened up her mouth. We see one other example like this in Scripture, right? It's in the Korah's rebellion phrase. Same words used. The earth opened up her mouth. And in this case, it swallows Korah and all of his stuff whole, live. But the curse is Cain is now cursed from the ground, from Ha'adama. When you till the ground, it ain't going to work. It shall not force yield unto you its strength. You will be a fugitive, a vagabond, a wanderer in Ha'aretz. Cain says to Yahuwah, I can't handle it. That's just over the top, man. I can't deal with that. My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me out. Here's that word again. Gerashat. Same word Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden. Now you have driven me out this day from the whole face of Ha'aretz, the land. And from your face shall I be hid. I'll be a fugitive and a wanderer in the earth. Well, that's what he just said. And it will come to pass. Whoever finds me, well, they'll do to me what I just done to my brother. They'll slay me. Yahuwah said to him, okay, listen. Therefore, whoever slays Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. Yahuwah set a sign on Cain, lest any man finding him should smite him. So this is called the mark of Cain. Everybody's heard about it. There is, as you might suspect, again, no shortage of speculation. What is it? Does Cain have horns? Right? Does Cain have a tattoo? Has Cain got a flashing red neon sign that says, don't kill me? The scripture does not tell us. But whatever it is, the mark of Cain certainly has been a source of, speculation ever since. At least ever since people who hadn't seen it have wondered back about what it was. So Cain went out from the presence of Yahuwah. He dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Edom. Now Cain too, he Yada, his wife. He intimately knew his wife. She conceived. She bore Enoch. Enoch built a city. He called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. And unto Enoch was born Irad. Irad bought Mehuyael. Mehuyael begot Methushael. And Methushael begot Lamech. Now notice, some of these names we're going to see again, not the same people. Lamech, he took to him two wives. Got two wives. First one's name is Ada. The name of the other is Zillah. So Ada, the first wife, she bore somebody named Yabal. He was the father of folks who dwell in tents and have cattle. So line of cattlemen comes from that wife. And his brother's name was Jubal. And some of us remember that name. It shows up in some pretty great novels. But anyway, brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all kinds of people who handled the harp and the pipe. So he was one of the primo first musicians. Now, the other one, Zillah, she bore Tubal-Cain. Tubal-Cain is a metal worker, the forger of every cutting instrument of brass and iron. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Lamech then says to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech, hearken unto my speech, because I have slain a man for wounding me and a young man for bruising me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. What does that mean? Now, I've heard it said. I don't necessarily believe it. What happened is, here's Lamech. He's out hunting. Here comes Cain. Doesn't see the mark. And he whacks old Cain, thinks maybe it's a deer and shoots him or does some. Again, speculation. It's not clear. About the only case that could be made is we've just finished talking about Cain, and he's got this mark, and now Lamech immediately, just a few verses after we get his lineage, is saying, if Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold. But we're not told specifically. Okay, now back to good old Adam. Adam, now he yadded his wife again. So he had conjugal relations, and she bore a son, called his name Seth. Quote, "For Elohim has appointed me another seed in replacement of." Literally, the word here is an interesting word, tachat. Instead of, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. I make this point. An eye in place of an eye is really how that should be rendered. And this is another seed in place of Abel, Seth. Because, you know, Cain slew that one. "Now, unto Seth, to him there was born a son, he called his name Enosh. And man," it says, "began to call upon the name Beshem Yahuwah." Chapter 5. And notice this is a long Torah portion. Again, so much information in here. This, it says, is the Sefer, the book of the generations, the Toldot of Adam. "In the day that Elohim created man, in the likeness of Elohim he made him, male and female he created them, and he blessed them, and he called their name," literally, their name Adam. So mankind, plural in this case. "In the day when they were created." Now we're going to get, and most people, at least that are serious students, have gone through this this exercise. I can remember having done it more than once. You can draw this on a chart, and you can lay out the lifetimes, and you can figure out how long all these things took, and who was born when, and who was alive at the same time, and then when the flood came, and all of that. So here we go. "Adam lived 130 years. He begot a son in his own likeness, after his image." That one, his name was Seth. "And the days of Adam, after he begot Seth, 800 years, he begot sons and daughters." Now, we're not told their names. Must have been a lot of them. "All the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and then he died." Seth, we know when he was born and how old Adam was when he was born. Well, Seth lived 105 years when he begot Enosh. After that, he lived 807 years. He begot other sons and other daughters. "All the days of Seth in total, 912 years, then he died. Enosh, he lived 90 years, he begot Kenan. And after that, after begotting, he begot Kenan, he lived another 815 years. He had lots of other sons and daughters. All the days of Enosh, 905 years, then he died. Kenan, at age 70, he begot Mahalalel. And after that, he lived 840 years, he had other sons and daughters. The days of Kenan, 910 years, he died. Mahalalel, he lived 65 years, begot Yared. And after that, he lived 830 years, other sons and daughters. The days of Mahalalel were 895 years, then he died. Jared, he lived 162 years, and then he begot, oh, now this name we've heard, this is the one that seems to be the famous one, Enoch. Jared lived, after he begot Enoch, another 800 years, and he too had other sons and daughters. All the days of Jared, or Yared, were 962 years, he died. Enoch, he lived 65 years. He begot another famous fellow, Methuselah. And it says this. Now, this is where the pattern is broken, as indeed in more than one way. Enoch walked with Elohim. And then he begot Methuselah after 300 years. And he had other sons and daughters. All the days of Enoch were 365 years. Now, notice, that's not nearly as long as these other ones, but wait. Enoch walked with Elohim, and then he just plain wasn't. He was, and then he wasn't. Elohim took him. He lachach him. He took him. Again, that same word. Like a man takes a wife, or you take a fruit off of a tree. Elohim took him. What's the implication? Well, it's clear, and this is one of those things that resonates throughout the centuries. Enoch does not seem to have ever died. He was just gone. Methuselah, he lived 807 years, then he begot Lamech. Again, that name we've heard, but this is a different Lamech. Methuselah lived after he begot Lamech, 782 years. He had other sons and daughters. And all the days of Methuselah, he has the record, we're going to find out, 969 years, then he died. Now, interesting things associated with Methuselah. We're going to talk about some of these in the next Torah portion, or as we transition here. Lamech, he lived 182 years. He begot a son. Guess what? His son's name, really famous name, his son's name is Noach. And he said the following. Now, the root here of this word, the first time we see the word Noach is right here. And the root word does have to do with comfort. This same shall comfort us. Yan, let's see, it's yanach manu us. He will comfort us in our work and the toil of our hands, which comes from ha'adama, which Yahuwah has cursed. We went through the begotting sequence there, and I think that's what people missed. But when the sequence ends, we're at the place where Noach, he shall comfort us. That root word is in there. In our work and the toil of our hands, which comes from ha'adama, which Yahuwah has cursed. Now, Lamech, back to the pattern, he, after he begot Noach, lived 595 years, and he begot other sons and daughters. And in total, the days of Lamech, 777 years. And then he died. And now it says, Noah, at age 500 years, he begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So he has these three sons. He's 500 years old when that happens. Now, chapter 6 is going to give us kind of a radical change, and it's interesting. The Torah portion ends just a little bit into this. The beginning of the story of Noah, we'll probably pick it up here next week too. But it says, it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of Elohim, the B'nai Ha-Elohim, saw the daughters of men. They were good looking. They were fair. And they took, that same word, lachak, the root word there, they took women, isha, whoever they wanted. There's a good-looking one, just going to take her. Yahuwah said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, because he too is flesh. Therefore, his day shall be 120 years. That one's fascinating. Is that 120 sequences of 50? Some would say so. If you do the math, that's 6,000 years. Isn't that interesting? 6 days of 1,000 years? Or maybe it's 120 years. That's about how long, for example, Moshe lived. We're going to see that after this point, men's lifespans are going to decline to the point where 120 years becomes an upper limit. So I think this is one of those verses that's true on more than one level. Let's leave it at that. But there are these things called ha-nephilim. The Nephilim were in the earth in those days, and also after that. There you go. Also after that. When the sons of Elohim came in unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These same were the mighty men that were of old, the men of renown. Now, some would say the Greek gods, some of the characters in the Norse mythologies and so forth. But the point is, there are a line of people here which are half-breeds of some kind or another, descendants of these Nephilim. There are other words that will be used, Raphaim and so forth. But these aren't the angelic things, the sons of Elohim themselves, but it's the descendants of that we're talking about when a lot of these men that were born to them, men of renown. You then saw that the wickedness of what? Ha-Adam, mankind? Ha-Adam, the man was great in the earth, and that every imagination, every purpose, every form of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Quite a phrase. The wickedness of Ha'adam was great in the earth, Ha'aretz, and every imagination of the thoughts of his hearts was just plain nothing but evil all the time, all the days. Kol Hayom. And it grieved Yahuwah, that he had ever made man Be'eretz on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. And Yahuwah said, I'm going to blot this thing out. I will blot out Ha'adam, mankind, whom I've created, from the face of the earth. Not just that, but man and beast and every creeping thing and fowl of the air, because it bugs me, it bothers me, it grieves me. The word in the Old English here that's used is repenteth. And it's not like he's turning in that sense, so I don't like that rendering. But it grieves me that I have made them. There's a very famous but, and I'll read it, but then we're going to pick it up here next week. It says, but, and here you go, Noah found chen. First use in the scripture. Noah found chen in the eyes of Yahuwah. What is it? Grace. Now, I always like, you know, people say, well, we're saved by faith through grace, and we don't want anybody boasting, not by works and so forth and so on. And I kind of got this idea that there was no grace up until a whole lot later, you know, after that page divider between the Old Testament and the New Testament. But that's not what it says. Noah has found chen, grace, in the eyes of Yahuwah right here. And of course, that's key. Everything else follows.